Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL 90.7 FM, Ocean City, Delmarva Public Radio. We take you now to Salisbury University's Research Day and Innovation Showcase. This was recorded Friday, September 27th, 2013. This is the first of two broadcasts from this event. Salisbury University's inaugural Research Day and Innovation Showcase highlighted current faculty endeavors and provided information about the various efforts connecting the university and the community. Participants learned how they could connect with the university's faculty, staff, and programs to help form solutions to strengthen our community. For more information on this event, please visit the website salisbury.edu/researchday.
Kicking us off, Dr. Dane Revisa, Associate Professor of Health and Sports Sciences.
Thank you very much. I figured today wasn't sure really how to go about this, so I figured that everyone likes to be told a story, so I'm going to pretty much preface this as a story. And the story is called Peaceful Play. During my doctoral studies, sitting in the depths of the library, all of you can certainly understand that, I received a phone call from a friend of mine at UNICEF, the UNICEF offices, and they asked me about coming over to Uganda to work on these projects called Sports for Development and Peace and their partnership projects. I went up to New York and had a meeting with them and had decided that I would go for it. And I came back, accelerated my studies, and a week after my defense, I went and was off to Uganda. The idea of Sport for Development and Peace was born from the idea of sport doing good. And in 2005, the United Nations declared that year as the year of sport and physical education for all children, seeing sport as a human right, also as a high impact, low cost way of addressing certain development needs. So it was an easy decision for me, but I approached it with cautious optimism because often sport can be seen, well, other areas as well, but exactly sport can be seen as a panacea for a lot of things, and I didn't want to be able to see it that way. So I headed to Uganda, and I was working in the southern part of the country for a good amount of the time that I was there in the very beginning. And I was going out, and I had actually secured a postdoc at that time, which was great. And I was in charge of monitoring and evaluating some of the partner programs that were mainly in the south of Uganda. In the southern part, they were addressing critical issues as HIV and AIDS education and malaria education through the use of sport as well, through these partner projects. But after a short period of time, I was asked to come up to northern Uganda, which was at the time the epicenter of one of Africa's longest standing conflicts. And I was up at the town of Gulu, and I was asked to come to the Gusco Child Reception Center for former abductees or former child soldiers, as you would know them. At this time, we could see that the region was in conflict for over about 20 years. And approximately 90% of the population lived in what was called internally displaced person camps, or you could view them as kind of like internal refugee camps. There was approximate numbers were at about 66,000 children and youth were abducted by the rebel groups known as the Lord's Resistance Army. They used child soldiering as their weapon of war. And it also spawned this idea of the night commuters, which was tens of thousands of children and youth that were leaving their homes and villages and walking to the town centers in order to avoid the abduction. So at this time, while at the Gusco Child Reception Center, I heard heinous stories of violence and the exposures to violence that the children endured. And as you can see, like in this particular drawing, they were asked to be able to illustrate some of the things that happened to them or how they saw their particular abductions. Boys were often sent to loot and torch villages and abduct unsuspecting other unsuspecting children from their homes and schools as well. And also children were made to march long distances at times under abduction, with the weaker ones that were fallen off to the wayside. Only the strongest survived in this sense, and others were left for dead. The conflict also had devastating consequences on our young girls. Large numbers of the girls were abducted and forced into what would be considered like forced marriages, or handed over as wives to a lot of the young commanders, often as prizes, and they also born children out in the bush and were returning back to that type of stigma as well, as often seen as damaged goods and unfit for marriage as well. So, at this time, when I was working at the Gusco Center, the local government officials also came to me and said, "Well, Prof Dean," and that's my African street name, "Prof Dean, you know, that's fine that we're working with former abductees, but can you also realize that all the children are war affected, and we want to expand this work to larger, to scale it up within the communities throughout northern Uganda." So, and that's true. This picture of the IDP camp certainly depicts that. At this time, like I said, approximately 90% of the population, upwards of almost 2 million people, were living in these camps. And we saw hundreds of thousands of children within these camps. And at that time, of course, they lacked security. The children didn't feel very safe there, and they also lacked educational and economic opportunities. So we discussed a lot with the local governments and local officials and how we could best frame this. How could we utilize sport and for it to address some of the critical needs? And what are those critical needs? I was able to meet some of the children out in the field, and we were able to discuss this with them through some observational periods. And we went in, for instance, how did sport play a role in Daniel's reintegration into his community? Daniel here was abducted for a period of almost 2 years. He rose through the ranks in the LRA, and then upon his escape, he was shot through the leg. And then, but also returning to his community, he was seen as a potential threat to peace. But interesting enough, when Daniel went back, when he healed and he went back to school, he was elected what was called the sport prefect or sport captain at the school, which was a position of very, very high honor. It was elected by his peers. And not only did I ask Daniel, I asked his peers at the school, "Why did you elect Daniel to this position?" And they said, "Oh, wow, oh, he's a very good organizer, and he's a very good leader, and he's very firm, and he keeps the equipment very well, you know, all together and stuff." And it was very interesting, because then I went back to Daniel. I said, "You know why they said this?" And said, "Why were you elected?" and stuff. And we talked, and it turned out that, you know, he garnered a lot of these skills while he was abducted. And so a lot of these leadership skills. And to be able to see that transition, and the transition through sport, you know, kind of put on a light bulb there and said, "Hey, maybe we have something here." But I still approach this with what I say cautious optimism, because I know, and as many of you are thinking out there, that sport also can incite violence as much as it can work to resolve conflict. And that's one of the things that I kept in the back of my mind the whole time. As I said, cautious optimism is how I went to approach it. But I also we also talked to many children out there. We talked to Mary, who was abducted for about 2 years' time and everything. And she was in charge of abducting other girls. And if someone tried to escape, she was ordered them to beat them to death. We talked to Samuel, who was back into his community and had his left arm hacked off by the rebels and left for dead. And when he escaped, he was back to his community and back in school. And he faced some of the stigma of not only being abducted, but also having now a physical disability. And then we talked to like Janet, who was out, who didn't go to school, who wasn't abducted, but she couldn't afford the school fees, but she was participating in a community program with sport that also looked at economic development and looked at, they were doing agricultural stuff, how to plant and how to grow some of their crops. And then also raising some of the chickens and stuff. They had a chicken farm with that and stuff. And sport was that tool that brought them together, that social mobilizer, if you will. So at that time, we again consulted with the local governments, and I had built a team of local northern Ugandans, well-skilled in their trades and definitely in tune to the conflict. And we really tried to do our best to discuss how is it that we can best go about understanding the particular needs of the community and how does sport play a role in that. So we went about and chose the participative research methodologies. At this time, as you see, we had approximately 10 to 12 children in particular cohorts. And these little groups, and not just 10 to 12, but we had upwards of 400, and through all of the different sub-counties throughout the conflict-affected districts. So, and within these groups, we had a good sample of former abductees and non-abductees, girls and boys, and individuals with disabilities as well. And our goal there was to understand the role of sport in the context as they saw it, and how sport can best serve them within their communities. It was very critical because there was multiple interpretations of sport and within this particular humanitarian crisis. And as we heard earlier, it was very important because as researchers, we can be very extracted in these particular situations. We go in with our clipboards and our surveys and our mobile devices, and we go and we're very intrusive and we collect data, and then we go and analyze that data, and we go off and we leave the communities, and we go and publish that data, and that information never gets back to those communities, and it's never utilized or put to good use. And, you know, we didn't want to do that. I don't see that as, especially in humanitarian issues, I didn't see that as neither ethical nor reasonable. So, going back. So a lot of the children here were grouped in groups of about 10 to 12, and they were given sticks and stones, approximately 10 stones or 10 sticks, and we laid out pictures as well. We laid out pictures and some local goods as well. And for them to be able to go and rank these particular needs as it was here, in some of these particular local methods, in some of the local goods there. And on the pictures as well, we looked at how, for instance, we would have maybe a picture of two individuals in an argument, or we had someone going to school, or we had somebody with a disability. And they would take those sticks or stones and place them on the pictures and stuff in terms of a kind of ranking methodology. And so what they particularly told us was that they could utilize sport as a form of social inclusion, a way to develop leadership skills. It was a pull factor to school. And also, but most importantly, one that really rose to the top was that sport can be utilized as a means for building peace within the communities. So, and just as a word of note, we know the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but they really do make for viable research methods. So we had that information, and then we heard from the children and youth, and then we wanted to move forward a bit and also engage other key stakeholders in the research. So for that, we went out, and with the district sports officers and the district education officers, we were able to identify large numbers of sport teachers and within the schools and community-based coaches as well. We had mainly sport teachers because there were not many community-based programs involving sport, but we were able to locate some individuals that were engaging in community-based sport as well. And we enlisted them in what was called a free listing exercise. So what we would do was pose a question. And the question then would be there to generate a list that could be discussed and then ranked by priority as well. So we would, for instance, ask the question, how does conflict occur when children and youth are participating in sport? One of the things that I liked most was that we wanted to always adhere to the culture, and they insisted that not only do they write this down, but they also wanted to act it out. And so, and that really added to the depth and understanding of that particular information as well. And then after careful analysis, we were able to determine different levels of conflict. that was occurring. And then we would ask another question. For instance, how do you resolve conflict when it occurs during sport? And through the careful analysis again, and you could see here where they're going and grouping and working together and ranking these priorities, we were able to know and understand culturally contextual strategies for resolving these particular conflicts that arise during participation in sport. So, and then we would settle on individual interviews as well. And we would go and ask them, for instance, tell us about the level that you described as called Jinmaraj. Now, I don't think any of you are really fluent in Luo, so I decided to put the English word down there. I was going to play with you, but I decided not to. So this idea of Jinmaraj. And we would ask a particular question in the interview, such as, how is the child demonstrating Jinmaraj behave? So we could get a good understanding of this level of conflict that they were describing. So I'm going to try, I won't try and do the best drama that was done, but because I'm not a very good actor, as they were. But I did try to know and understand these particular levels as they explained it. And the idea of Jinmaraj, or what we had translated into what was called a harmful level of conflict in sport, was the idea of kind of a latent type of conflict, or something that had occurred outside of sport, and then was brought into the sporting arena. For instance, they did a great interpretation and stuff. They said, you, I see you across the field, and you had killed my brother, or you had torched my village, or you committed some other act against members of my community. And we were able to go and understand that, because then they would wait and see, maybe within the sporting context, they would go and then inflict some type of physical violence against that individual within the sporting arena. And so, and we had no idea that that was happening. And so we understood that through their interpretations and stuff, that it was happening. We were able to locate that, to understand that. And not only were we able to understand it, then we were able to develop culturally contextual ways to be able to address that, which was very important. So through all of this research, we were able to go and produced what we called Peaceful Play, as the story is entitled, and Strategies for Resolution to Conflict in Sport. But also I kind of interchanged that word in the title to through, because we also don't want to keep this within a box. If the idea of is building inclusive, more peaceful communities, that we want to be able to transfer these strategies to areas of low-level conflict in homeschooling community. So, the Peaceful Play program involves four levels of conflict in sport and the culturally contextual strategies for resolution to that conflict. And at this time, we're going and implementing this in four of the conflict-affected district, with a large number of sport teachers and coaches, with the next phase being the idea of involving the youth as these type of peace builders as well, and addressing conflict as they see it as well, along these lines of these particular strategies. So that's where I'm going to leave you today, where we're at. Like I said, we wanted to be able to look at the ability to be able to transfer this knowledge to other areas of conflict. But we also want to operate within an idea of conflict sensitivity, an idea that we're trying to produce now, that it's looking at the intersection of the idea of child protection, trauma sensitivity, and conflict as well that's occurring in sport. So that way then we can maybe even prevent conflict from happening rather than having to address it after it occurs. So I'm just going to leave you with the idea that the old African saying that not only does it take a village to raise a child, but it also takes a village sometimes to address humanitarian needs. And in this case, we're looking at utilizing the individuals within the communities to be able to build inclusive communities through sport for young survivors of war. Thank you.
Next up, we have Dr. Ryan Taylor, Associate Professor of Biology.
Okay, well, thanks for coming. So I'm going to talk to you today a little bit about, frogs. And What can we say about frogs?
I guess they hop. 1 minute they're here, then they're there. They've been a staple of high school anatomy dissection labs since the dawn of civilized education. And occasionally even the subjects of really bad horror movies. But what I hope to convince you of by the time I'm finished talking is that frogs can actually tell us a lot about the evolution of life on this planet and may even play a role in helping us understand something about human hearing. So about 150 years ago, this guy Chuck D, better known as Charles Darwin, came up with this idea that organisms should be better selected over time or better adapted to survive and reproduce in their natural habitats. So if you can see this frog here, it's a leaf litter toad on the floor of the forest in Panama, blends in quite nicely with those leaves, thereby avoiding predators, and this fits very nicely with Chuck D's idea of natural selection. Likewise, timber rattlesnake blends in very nicely with the background. These guys sit next to logs, wait for squirrels to come running by the logs, nail the squirrel, right, get a meal. And by blending in, the squirrels don't seem to notice them. It's a really effective strategy for procuring a meal. But there was a problem with Darwin's theory. He recognized that some animals didn't really fit his idea very well, that some animals weren't better suited for crypsis and avoiding predation and predators. In fact, they seemed to stand out. We can look across the animal kingdom and see myriad species that really kind of buck this trend and have very extravagant displays, behaviors, color patterns, you name it. Classic example is the peacock, right? And so Darwin realized that this didn't fit. These seemed to be advertisements to predators saying, hey, come eat me. You know, this didn't really work so well. So what Darwin figured out then was that there's another process at play, what he called sexual selection. So in effect, through female mate choice, it's the females that drive males toward these ever more extravagant behaviors, displays, traits, etc. So for male peacocks, for example, the eye spots seem to be really important. Those males that have fewer eye spots on the tail don't get mates. They don't leave those traits in the next generation. And so it's the females then that drive those courtship displays towards more and more elaborate and exaggerated morphologies that we actually see. So I work on this question. I'm interested in understanding how female choice and animal communication through courtship signals then leads to the evolution of these diverse behaviors and traits that we see in the animal kingdom. So to give you a little background on frogs, typically, in almost all species at night, males come down to the pond. They begin vocalizing, producing these courtship advertisements to females. Females come down to the pond, they listen to the males, and choose one to mate with. On any given night, there's intense competition among the males for mates. It's not unusual for the sex ratio maybe to be 10 or 20 males for every female that comes to the pond. So males are engaging in this intense vocal competition for access to mates. So in this video, I'm going to show you, it's a male tundra frog vocalizing in the pond. And what I want you to notice, aside from the vocalization, is this very conspicuous vocal sac that he's inflating under his chin. So male frogs, unlike humans, when we speak and expel air, they capture the expelled air in this vocal sac and then recycle it back into the lungs during bouts of calling. And that vocal sac is going to become important, which I'll talk about in a minute. Okay, so unfortunately, the tundra frog is a rather unattractive tropical species. It doesn't hold quite the appeal of the red-eyed tree frog, but biologically, it's really rather fascinating. So tundra frogs do something that very few frog species do, and they actually produce two notes to their calls. Most frogs produce a very simple, very stereotyped call. It's repeated over and over. Male tundra frogs produce this whine. If you see in the oscillogram there on your left, it's sort of this sort of frequency sweep that trails off. And then males can voluntarily add a second note or burst of energy to that call that we call the chuck. So they always make the whine, and then they can voluntarily add the chuck to their call. So the whine sounds like this. And if they add the chuck, that second note to the call, it sounds like this. to that extra burst of energy. What I can tell you is when males add the chuck, the chicks really dig it. If a male's adding that chuck to his wine, he has about a fivefold increase in probability of attracting a mate. So females will respond to the wine only, but when males add that chuck, it really increases the attractiveness of that call. And the other interesting thing about frogs, I was just talking to you about that vocal sac. Across species, the vocal sac morphology is rather diverse. So if you see up in the left-hand corner, our squirrel tree frog has this very large, translucent, rather conspicuous vocal sac. In the bottom left corner, that's Phrynichias. This guy's really bizarre. It has dual vocal sacs that actually wrap up around the back of his head when he's vocalizing. Tundra frogs, for their body size, really have an enormous vocal sac. And some frogs, like the gladiator frog down in the right-hand corner, a rather big frog, but they have this diminutive vocal sac. It's rather unimpressive for the frog. So I got to thinking a little bit about the role of this vocal sac. And if you think about the variation in morphology, this is way more diverse than it needs to be for sound production. And the other aspect of frogs is that they communicate in situations that are analogous to the human cocktail party. So it's not that one male comes down to the pond and he's calling and, you know, way over there is another male. They gather in high densities and they're calling, and those calls overlap a lot. So they sound something like this. This is a Tundra frog chorus. How many frogs are calling in that clip? Yeah, I don't know either. It's a lot. Okay, the problem that females have is they have to parse out which male is making which call. So if they're going to identify individual males by their calls to assess them as a potential mate, they've got to do what we call auditory stream analysis. They've got to assign callers with their call, right, out of this cacophony of noise. And we have pretty good data now that these frogs are actually not that good at doing this by ear. So I started thinking about this vocal sac and realized that, you know, maybe this vocal sac plays a role as well. So in human cocktail parties, what we do to improve our speech comprehension is lip reading. So I wondered, since male frogs are expanding that vocal sac at the same time as making the vocalization, are females paying attention to that vocal sac, analogous to human lip reading? So to address this question, enter RoboFrog. The problem with being a behavioral biologist like myself is you cannot go to Fisher and buy the tools that you need. If you're a molecular biologist, you can buy PCR machines and all these sorts of things. Fisher doesn't carry robotic Tundra frogs. So I met one of my collaborators when I was a postdoc at Texas. This guy is a phenomenal artist, had a friend who was an engineer, and as it turns out, the three of us got together and built this robotic frog. I believe at the table after the talk this evening, we'll have a demonstration of this guy. And so we built this robotic frog with an inflatable vocal sac to allow us then to ask questions about how females are assessing both acoustic signals and visual signals. And this is a picture of RoboFrog in action, or video. There's the female, there she is. And the great thing about this system is that we literally ask the females, what do you like? So when male frogs come down to the pond and vocalize, they don't normally seek out females. They find a spot, they begin vocalizing, and they don't sort of move around actively looking for females. They vocalize, wait for the females to come to them. So by setting up these acoustic and robotic playbacks here, we can literally ask the female, what do you like? And she'll go over, climb on the speaker, climb on the robotic frog, indicating that that's the mate choice that she would have made in nature. So in our typical setup, this is kind of our experimental arena. So we have a sound dampening chamber. We put the female in the middle of the chamber. We have two speakers on either side. We digitally synthesize male calls, play them back to the female from the speakers, and we can place the robotic frog in front of one of the speakers and alter the timing of its vocal sac inflation relative to the call. So we can essentially mix and match and ask the female, how are you responding to the visual and the acoustic components? Okay, so a little bit of background. What I have here is kind of a cartoon diagram or waveform of a standard Tundra frog wine chuck. So the big shape in the front is the wine, followed by that burst of energy at the end, the chuck. So one of the things that we did is we digitally moved the chuck. So we pulled it out away from the wine, we created a silent gap between the wine and the chuck, And we pitted that against the normal call, the normal wine check. And we put the females in the arena. We asked them, what do you like? And the females responded as if this wine with the artificially separated chuck responded as if the chuck didn't exist. So they treated it as if it was just a wine only and really responded to that normal wine chuck. And this might not be too surprising because if we put artificial gaps in our own speech, it's hard to comprehend. So what happens is the females are not recognizing this chuck belongs to the wine anymore. So the other thing that we did is we took the robotic frog, if you want to focus on the top panel here, is we moved that out in time away from the call. So females heard the wine chuck, then she saw the robotic frog inflate. When we did this, females avoided this like the plague. So the females told us there's something wrong here. It's like watching the old Kung Fu movies, right? Where they're badly dubbed and the lips and the don't match up. And okay, the females responded in a similar fashion, right? They avoided this, indicating that this is not normal. It's something that they're just not perceiving as a normal mating signal. So we hypothesized that perhaps the really important aspect of the visual component of the vocal sac is really allowing females to do this auditory scene analysis, whereby females can look at the movement of the vocal sac, listen to the timing of a call, and then ask, or then use that to sort of localize where males are in the chorus. So we developed this perceptual rescue hypothesis, and what we did is said, okay, if females are really using the vocal sac to assess male calls and tie those calls to individual males within the chorus, then the vocal sac in between the whine and the chuck should essentially rescue the chuck, that displaced chuck, and bring those back together in the female's auditory system. So we gave females the stimulus, whine, robofrog inflation, then the chuck, and indeed they responded, again, as this was one single coherent signal again. So this lent strength to this idea of perceptual rescue, that the visual component is actually binding the two auditory components together in the female's auditory system. Okay, so just sort of to summarize this, I'll tell you how the Tungra frog got its call. So getting back to this idea of sexual selection, my collaborator, Mike Ryan, at the University of Texas, has been working on this system for about 30 years, and it's been very clear that it's this female mate choice, the female mating preferences that have driven the evolution of this call properties in this particular species towards having that chuck. Males make the chuck, they're more likely to attract a mate and leave those genes in the next generation. So what we now have also is a series of papers then with a robotic frog showing that this integration of the visual component with the acoustic component is really important for the females as well. So not unlike humans, the frogs seem to be doing a little bit of lip reading in these choruses and helping using that to help them assign calls to individual males. Okay, so I mentioned the cocktail party. So this was a coined term actually by Cherry in 1953, and it's been really a source of a lot of research, especially as of late. And it's a problem I think we're all familiar with. You're having a conversation. So you're in a noisy environment. You're having a conversation with someone, and it's hard to pick out what they're saying. Remarkably, our ear is actually quite good at sort of filtering out surrounding noise and paying attention to the person we're talking to and really extracting information out of that stream of words. Our ear uses a variety of tricks to do this. We filter out frequency or pitch, right? So you kind of pay attention to the pitch of that person's voice and your ear filters out other frequencies a little bit. We do this thing called dip listening. There's a slight lull. Your brain really latches onto those few words and kind of puts information together. And of course, we lip read as well. Okay, so just to kind of give you an example of some of the things that our ears do, I'm going to show you this thing called the continuity illusion. So our ears, as I mentioned, are quite good, quite adept at extracting signals from noise, but our ears are not perfect. So this continuity illusion, when I play it, what you're going to hear is a series of tones. It's not a very nice sound, but it's just a series of beeps that you'll hear, and you'll hear the individual tones with a silent gap in between each one. Then I'm going to put white noise in those gaps, and the white noise will get louder and louder and louder, and you'll begin prominently hearing the white noise, but continue to listen to the tones in the background. And what's going to happen is you will fail to be able to recognize individual tones in the background. It'll sound like the tone is playing continuously in the background. Then as I drop the white noise down, you'll hear the individual tones again. So really pay attention to the tones in the background behind the white noise. Okay, so the silent gaps did not go away. I didn't change the spacing in those tones, but what happens is when your brain is getting a burst of additional frequencies, your brain can no longer separate out those individual individual tones, and your brain just says, oh, this is one continuous stream, right? So our ear is pretty good at filtering out noise and detecting signals, but it's far from perfect. So the other thing that we do is as I mentioned, lip read. So by reading lips in noisy environments, we can increase speech comprehension by about 50%. So just by watching your speaker's lips, we really increase our ability to understand what the speaker is saying. But this also is not perfect. So in the very famous Hearing Lips and Seeing Voices paper by McGurk and McDonald, they found that the visual component of lip reading really alters how we actually hear sounds. And I think I can best exemplify this with this quick video. So just kind of pay attention to the video and listen to what they're saying.
Ba, ba, ba.
Have
ba,
a look at this.
Ba,
what do you
ba.
Hear?
Ba, ba, ba. Ba, ba, ba.
But look what ba, happens ba, when we change the picture.
Ba, ba, ba. Ba. Ba, ba, ba.
And yet, ba, the sound ba, hasn't changed. In ba, every clip, ba, you are only ba, ever hearing ba, ba with a B.
Ba, ba.
It's a little disconcerting, isn't it? So in reality, you're not always hearing what you think you hear. So in particular, when we're lip reading, the movement of the lips really can radically influence how you hear these basic components of speech. So what this suggests very clearly then is that our brain is integrating our auditory perception with visual perception. And just kind of as a side note, and another nice example of this, we know that not only humans do this, but so do owls. So there was a study a number of years ago where they took little owlets and they raised them as chicks, and they put, it's kind of sad, they put little spectacles on these owls and they raised them. And the spectacles displaced the horizon by 17 degrees. So they raised up these little owls for months and months with spectacles on. And then they took the spectacles off, and they allowed the owls to hunt naturally. And what I can tell you is owls can hunt in complete darkness just by sound. They have phenomenal ears that can really triangulate and pinpoint sounds. And just by sound alone, they can catch mice in the leaf litter on a forest floor by pinpointing the location of that sound. So they took these owls, raised with spectacles on, displaced the horizon by 17 degrees, let them go out and hunt, and they missed the sounds by 17 degrees. So early in the life, early in the development of the brain of these owls, they were using vision to create an auditory spatial map in their brain. So it's really clear that a lot of vertebrates are actually very strongly integrating both visual and auditory components in terms of their sensory perception. So in essence, what I did is I have a frog brain up here, just to kind of remind me. So what we found with this perceptual rescue, whereby we can take a totally artificial male mating signal, right? So in nature, a male could never displace the timing of the vocal sac inflation from the chuck and the whine. But when we sandwich the vocal sac in between them, females respond again, as this is a single perceptual signal that is correct. And frogs are doing this with an extraordinarily small brain. They lack an auditory neocortex, the higher centers in our brain that are responsible for really intense auditory processing. And so there are a lot of structures in the brain that the frogs lack relative to humans or are greatly reduced, and yet the frogs are responding in very similar manners to the way we as humans do in terms of audiovisual integration. So I think that this actually has a lot of promise for helping us understand sort of this basic evolution of auditory visual processing in the vertebrate brain, and it suggests a very fundamental and basic underlying neurological processing that occurs in the vertebrate brain for helping us to extract information from the world around us. So with that, I'll just say that this project has been an enormous effort. So it's been funded by the National Science Foundation, the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, the Henson School of Sciences, and we've had lots of support for graduate studies and research. We certainly appreciate all of these folks. And finally, I have to say, sometimes the results that we get are a little surprising. And again, we've had a lot of folks working on this project. My collaborators, Michael Ryan and Rachel Page. Kim Hunter came down to Panama to work with us this past year, starting the genetic component of this project. Barrett Klein and Joey Stein really designed the robotic frog. And Kyle and Kelsey, who are my graduate students pictured here, I'd like to echo what Art Limbo said, in that what we're doing here at Salisbury University is not just giving students these simple projects, kind of as busy work, but these guys have come down with us for 2 years, spent the entire summer working in Panama, and have really become collaborators. They're developing projects, which by next year I expect we're going to have some fantastic publications coming out from the work that these guys have done. And just to kind of put it in perspective as well, so my collaborator, Mike Ryan, is the leader in the field of sexual selection and evolutionary biology. He never seeks out students. Right. So one of his students told us that she actually stalked him, traveled all the way to Cuba to introduce herself to him at a meeting in Cuba in the hopes of getting into his research lab. And after working with Mike for a couple of summers, Mike's been asking me, hey, Kyle and Kelsey are going to come work with me, right? So he's actually courting them a little bit. And these guys have done an amazing job and can certainly hold their own with the best doctoral students at any institution anywhere. So thank you.
Our next presenters, starting first up to bat, Dr. Sarah Surek, assistant professor from political science and environmental studies.
My research stinks, literally. Over the past 13 years, I've been in more garbage cans than I can actually count. And I really like what I do and what I study. It's been greatly influenced by my experiences over life with my research questions. I'm a political scientist by training. I like to be hands-on in terms of my research and what I think about. And in this, I like to think about what we call the politics of waste. What does it mean to have this material circulating through our society? So as I said, my research questions, and I'm 2 years out of my PhD, so I'll let you know that in terms of where I am with my research questions are based on my past experience. I began as a college student interested in campus activism, annoying my administrators, wanting a campus recycling program. Eventually, they hired me to run a recycling program after graduation, and much to my dad's chagrin, who said, I put you through 4 years of college so you could become a garbage collector. Little did he know I would be in front of a podium like he is today in his profession. So I've been an EPA waste researcher. I've consulted for municipalities across the country when it comes to waste management practices. And today I'm what people call a scholar of discard studies. That's a fancy name for people who study the political, social, economic, and spatial relations of our garbage, of our waste. My time as a campus recycling coordinator really influenced how I think about waste management. I learned a couple of things that are really important. The first thing that I learned is that if you ever sit next to someone on an airplane, you should never tell them that you're in the recycling industry. What follows is usually a long description of individual recycling habits, stories of people rinsing out and saving every single yogurt container, stacking them in their garage because someday they want to be able to do something with that material. And you also have people confessing environmental sins to you. My favorite one is the not wanting to rinse out the peanut butter container, feeling really, really bad about it. So I'm happy to listen to your environmental sins. I'm happy to provide some absolution to them. But by the end of my talk, you might not think that you need to be absolved from those sins anymore. The second thing that I learned as a recycling coordinator is that people like to play what I call recycling coordinator trivia or waste management trivia. No matter what my presentation was about or what I was talking about, at the end of the entire presentation, someone would say, I want to know, can I recycle my glass bottle if I have a lime in the bottom of it? Or do I need to leave my lid on my plastic bottle to recycle it, or do I need to take it off? All of these simple questions. People wanted to know about the individual object of waste, rather than what I was saying. They were concentrating on this the whole time. You could usually tell that for the course of this. And so this made me think about the object of waste. Why are we so connected to something that we try so hard to ignore, to put away? We put it in black bags. We roll it to the street in containers that have lids on it. We don't want to think about it. We spend so much time, though, thinking about these things that we don't want to think about, this act of waste. And so people tend to feel violated, actually, when people go through their garbage. Now, your private property rights end when you put your garbage out on the curb. That's been established through legal law. If you committed a crime and you put the material in the garbage and it goes out on the curb, you can actually use that in trial at that point. But people feel violated by this, by people seeing what's in their garbage. Because what we throw in our garbage are often things we don't want people to see, or we don't want to even think about ourselves. Trinkets from a breakup. Lots of wrappers of German chocolate in your trash can at work. Or things of a very personal nature, for example. We throw these away. We don't want to think of them. We want wasting to be anonymous. But our waste is never anonymous. It's never private. It is a public process as soon as it leaves our private property, and sometimes if it's doing damage on our private property. So as I was having these conversations on airplanes or after giving presentations, I started thinking about why do we connect so much with waste, and what can waste tell us, and how can we start thinking about waste, and even can waste answer some bigger questions for us? So as a recycling coordinator, what I found was the only thing that I could deal with were the things that people had given to me, the waste as it comes to me. And after about 5 years, I noticed that our recycling rates were going up. That was good. I was doing my job. But also our garbage rates were going up as well. Were we really making a difference? Was putting out all of these recycling bins and working on recycling practices actually doing anything in the long run? I became very frustrated trying to deal with why we have this waste in the first place. So I went back to graduate school with these questions in mind. I wanted to know why we even have waste, why I was even employed in such a job, who makes it, who should be responsible for it. But overall, I wanted to know the answer to this question. And as I found, when I went back to graduate school and started trying to read literature within political science, within public policy studies, there's not a lot of work written on why we have waste, especially from the political perspective, which is great for a researcher. But it's very hard when you're trying to write a dissertation. So I ended up reading all of the material I could find, from anthropology to sociology to cultural studies to economics to geography. Geographers are really great at looking at this type of question. And I was trying to explore, well, how can we think about this? How should we be thinking about waste? So this is what the main focus of my research remains. And this is what we're going to talk about today, trying to get answers to why we have waste. But there's a few things we need to know about waste before we can talk about that. The first thing is that there is no away. While we often talk about throwing waste away, throwing garbage away, garbage never goes away. This is William Rathje. He's a pretty famous anthropologist from Arizona. He recently passed away, and his work shows that there is no away. He, as an anthropologist, he was interested in consumer purchasing habits in the United States. So he and his four graduate students actually excavated landfills to look to see what people were throwing away. And because of his work, we know several things. Number one, while we like to think that all of our organic material that we throw away goes into a landfill and somehow forms some nice organic matter at the end of it, that is not true. The lack of oxygen and the lack of moisture in most landfills means that if you're someone like William Rathje, who wants to study what's in our landfill, you can do landfill excavation and you can find cuts of meat and banana peels from the 1920s. And you know that there's still cuts of meat and there's still banana peels. You can even read newspapers from the 1920s that have been excavated from landfills. Nothing goes away. The second point. We as Americans make a lot of waste. On average, 4.4 pounds is what you throw away or recycle in your activities, in your home, in your office, in hospitals, in schools like this. And you can see our waste production has been increasing over time. We had a little blip with the financial crisis, our recycling blipped with the financial crisis because we weren't making enough stuff to throw away to keep our numbers going up, but we make a lot of waste. This is what we know. What I think is more interesting, though, is what we don't know. While we record how much waste comes out of our homes and our offices and our schools, we do not record in this country how much non-hazardous waste is made in the process of producing all of this stuff that we then throw away. The estimate is that this is only capturing 15% of the non-hazardous waste produced in the United States. The estimate of industrial, that's the estimate in comparison to industrial waste, which we aren't even measuring. So to me, the question becomes, why don't we know this? Why aren't we asking these questions? And that is a political question. We have federal regulations for dealing with our clean air, for clean water. Our waste regulations, I would say, are quite subpar in comparison to other states. We don't require any sort of robust federal recording of any kind of data beyond simply the municipal solid waste management. And because of that, we don't have a good grasp as to what's going on in the type of waste that we're actually producing. And I think, though, what we also need to be thinking about here is not asking the question of how do we deal with waste once we make it, but asking again the question of why do we have waste in the first place? Why are we actually making this waste so that we need to deal with it and we need to do something with it in the end? We often think of waste as a very individual experience. I make waste. The person that's responsible for all of this garbage somewhere is an individual. It's me. It's because I throw things away. Here's why I begin to absolve you of some of your environmental sins, though. While we tend to individualize this process of wasting, our process or our procedure, what we can actually do with our material that we no longer want, is limited by two key factors. First of all, it's limited by the government. It's the government, since most across the world, beginning in the 1880s, municipal governments began regulating waste disposal for sanitation purposes, for aesthetic purposes, for economic purposes, to have streets free of movement, or to have clear streets so that we could have movement of economic products. For all of these reasons, we began to see the government playing a role in waste management. Governments today are responsible, for the most part, across the globe, for managing solid waste. And it's governments who decide what can go to a landfill, what is banned from a landfill, how we're picking up material, even what you can recycle on the individual level in your home or in your office. It is an inherently political decision. And it's a political decision when we see waste not collected. This is Naples, famous for garbage strikes. And we see what happens when we don't deal with this very, very important part of our community, of cleaning up the waste, because there are health and safety aspects when we don't clean it up. So the ability for you to deal with waste on the individual level is restrained, constrained, limited, accentuated by how our political systems operate and what rules are actually put into place for this. Second, industry also makes a decision as to how you can manage waste. While we like to think that we get to decide what we do with things when we throw them away, decisions have already been made for you by the time you put that yogurt container in your shopping cart. We've known and have really well documented instances, even in the trade literature since the 1950s, of corporations designing death dates into products. Things aren't built to last very long. My favorite example is the electrical lights in the State House in South Carolina. They were designed by Thomas Edison, and they still work. You can still turn on those lights. They were not designed to burn out, like we see with light bulbs, most light bulbs today. Industry decides how long your products are going to last. And industry also decides whether you're going to be able to recycle that product when it reaches the end of life, whether they're going to use a plastic that's easily recyclable within a municipal system, that's cost-effective to recycle, that doesn't have a large environmental impact to recycle. That is all determined by industry before you even put something in your shopping cart. So we have these two types of constraints. The question is, what do they mean? What do they do for us? How can we think about our management of waste in this way? Well, my research, as I come back to this question of why do we make waste, we all know the typical recycling, reuse, reduce, recycle, reduce, reuse, recycle, the MOBIS. I'm really interested in points number 2 and number 3 on this. Specifically, in things like what we try to do, how corporations can be encouraged or mandated to think about how products are actually designed in order to encourage recycling when it's time for a product to be recycled or at end of life. So there's a concept called extended producer responsibility. We see this in a lot of European Union legislation. And the point of this legislation is to encourage, or is to actually force, producers to make more recyclable products and to reduce their amount of waste overall. In this, what we're doing is changing property rights. So usually you buy a product, when you're done with your product, you throw it away. Extended producer responsibility, and the municipal government is responsible for dealing with that waste, and they bear the cost of it, and it's very expensive. Extended producer responsibility means at the time of disposal, when you throw that away, it's no longer your responsibility. It's not the municipality's responsibility. Property rights go back on the producer, and they are responsible for disposing of it. The idea is that they'll make a better product. They'll make it more environmentally friendly. Sounds great. If you've ever been to Europe, in Germany, for example, you can recycle all of your packaging. Sounds great. Does it work? Does it actually do this? Well, what we find is that this is the question we're not asking within our policy literature. We assume that since things are being recycled, things are going well. Look at these really high recycling rates. That's awesome. Well, I wanted to know if this was really awesome. So I went and asked German automakers, because they're required to do extended producer responsibility. I said, hey, has this shifted your production? Because that's what the government says it does. And that's what the government says it does in promoting all of these other types of policies, because you had a really early policy back in 1992 for the German government in thinking about extended producer responsibility. And the automakers all told me, no, doesn't make a bit of difference. The engineers were a little bit more upfront about it, but the PR people would say the same thing. These policies are not doing what we intended them to do. But nobody's asking these questions. We're just making these assumptions that they're doing what they're supposed to do. So my research is now expanding to other types of products. Because if we don't have a really good grasp of the implications of what our policies are trying to do, what does that mean for trying to push these policies and other types of policies in the future? I'm also interested still in this last R of recycling. And so I'm currently working on a manuscript that'll be published with Routledge in a year or so. And what I'm doing is I'm assessing municipal waste management practices specifically in terms of recycling and sustainability. Yet another non-sexy topic, I guess. Nobody else has written on this before, so I get to look at it. And what I'm trying to do is provide a state of, basically assess the state of recycling today and provide a baseline for it, as well as look at some of the innovative things that we're seeing within communities. And actually looking to see, are they making a difference? Things like economies of sharing, which have become really popular lately, or zero waste towns, signing of zero waste documents on the state level, wanting to know whether what's going on with these policies and if they're actually effective or not. Americans produce 250 million tons of solid waste, the municipal solid waste, the stuff that we actually know about, each year. And we need to do a better job of thinking about this waste, of trying to understand why we have it in the first place so that we can manage it in the future. So overall, while we tend to think of wasting as this very individual process, and we put a lot of blame on ourselves for why we have these types of waste, what we tend to do when we individualize it is forget all of the other important aspects, including are people who actually manage it. There are tangible social relations that are going on with how we manage waste. It's very dirty, it's very dangerous, it's a hazardous effort. We tend to not place a high value on people in society who do this necessary, important job for us. But we also tend to forget that we're operating within these political and social relations that can either constrain or expand our ability to be able to deal with waste in some way. So in the end, the decision isn't simply, you know, if I don't recycle this can, should I feel guilty about it? You know, the sort of individual level, what am I doing? The bigger question is, why do you have waste? And it's not because you didn't recycle your can, it's because of our political and our social relations and how we decide to arrange our waste management practices.
You have been listening to a selection of recordings from Salisbury University's Research Day and Innovation Showcase. These recordings are made on Friday, September 27th, 2013, on the campus of Salisbury University. For more information, visit salisbury.edu/researchday. You're listening to Delmarva Public Radio. You have been listening to Salisbury University's inaugural Research Day and Innovation Showcase, recorded Friday, September 27th, 2013. For more information, visit salisbury.edu/researchday.